Slave labor was cheap, but then it became very expensive. Illegal immigrant labor is cheap, but it too is becoming very expensive. The extremely high cost of cheap labor leads us to ask, should we have a guest worker program?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 929th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Tumut who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour. File this under Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't. They tell us 53% of U.S. farm laborers are illegal immigrants, which means that over one half of our food now comes courtesy of illegal hands. Agriculture, along with every other industry that we could think of, hires illegal immigrants because they are a source of cheap labor. But how cheap is cheap labor? America's first source of cheap labor was the slave. You could buy them at the market, put them up in a shack out back, work them at the fields all day and pay them nothing but some food and clothing. Slave labor was very cheap for the very few who owned the slaves, but became very expensive for the very many who did not own them. Today, a couple of hundred years down the line, the costs of cheap slave labor are still being paid in many different ways. If we were to add up the true costs paid by the many for the cheap slave labor employed by the few, we would see that cheap slave labor might well add up to $1 million a day. But hey, that's just my guess. What's yours? Today's cheap labor comes from the hands of illegal immigrants, which some call undocumented immigrants. Like slaves, illegal immigrant laborers do not have many rights, and so may be employed and discharged without the tremendous cost now incurred for hiring and firing domestic laborers. Still, it is becoming increasingly obvious that cheap immigrant labor employed by the few will become the very expensive labor paid for by all. The tremendous costs of this cheap labor leads us to ask, should the United States have a guest worker program? And here to help us labor on an answer about labor,
we have a couple of guests who could probably fill us in pretty good. We're going to start with Ken Forth. Ken is the president of Farm Agricultural Resource Management Services, better known as FARMS, and he is also an Ontario farmer. Ken, welcome to the food chain.
Well, good morning.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You're a farmer?
Yes, I am.
And what have you been farming?
We grow broccoli and lettuce in Hamilton, Ontario, halfway between Toronto and Buffalo, New York.
Sixth generation?
Yes, at least.
Been doing it a long time then, in your family.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the Foreign Agriculture Resource Management Services.
We've had a guest worker program in Ontario since 1966. It very much parallels a lot of parts of the U.S. H-2A program. Anyway, around 1984, the government no longer wanted to be involved in the administration of the program. They only wanted to say, approve an employer, yes or no. And then everything else, they didn't want to do it. You know, connection right. with the foreign countries and all the travel and admin and all that. So we set up a business called the Foreign Agriculture Resource Management Service to do the administration work.
So this is a private business.
Well, it's owned by the growers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a non-profit, like we do it for what it costs to do it. We have about 9 or 10 staff, and we administer about 18,000 job placements a year.
Wow, that's substantial then. And you've been doing it since 1966?
Yes. Well, farms have been in place since 1987, prior to that, the government was doing some of the admin work, but it wasn't as big a program as it is now. It was only 5,000 workers, and now there's across Canada about 25,000 workers. We don't administer all those. Farms does Ontario and Atlantic Canada.
Wow, okay, so the eastern part of the country then.
Except Quebec. We do not do Quebec. There's a similar system in Quebec.
Okay, good. Lot of farms, a lot of farm workers.
Yeah, about 1,500 farm employers. And,
yeah. Wow. Okay. Also with us today, we have Bruce Neuberger. Bruce is the author of Lettuce Wars. Bruce, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you aboard. So, Bruce, you're not a farmer, and you're not a farm worker anymore, but you were one, a farm worker once, weren't you?
Well, I worked in the fields from 1971 to 1980, and I've kept in contact with a lot of the farm workers and with the situation among farm workers, and I've been teaching English as a second language for 27 years, so I have a lot of contact with immigrants on a regular basis.
Okay, good. What is Lettuce Wars?
Well, Lettuce Wars is a story. It comes from the experience that I had during the 1970s, which was a period of tremendous upheaval, both in the world and in fields in particular. There was a farm worker movement that began in the mid-60s. It spread to the coastal areas where the lettuce is grown, broccoli and cauliflower and other products are grown, in 1970 with a major strike. And it just so happened by coincidence I happened to be living in that area. I end up working in the fields, and I am staying there for 10 years because I was inspired really by the movement that was going on there. So I wrote a book about it. That's what Lettuce Wars is. It's a book about the people, and it's about the politics, and it's about the overall social atmosphere of the times.
Good enough. And there we are, folks. So the topic on the table today is guest worker program. The folks up in Canada have one that works very good and has been working since 1966. I think we have an H2A program. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Yes, here in the United States. But it does not appear to be working too well because farmers throughout California, at least, are having such a hard time finding farm workers that they are looking at the necessity of losing some of their crops, leaving them in the field, unharvested. So something is not working too well. We have been relying principally here in the United States on the undocumented workforce of people that sneak across the border and work in our fields. And that does not appear to be working too well either, and you know it's going to cost a lot of money for society to pick up those costs. So the question today is, should we reestablish a good, thorough guest worker program like we had in the past? It was called the Bracero program. We got rid of it, and now we've been kind of relying on undocumented labor. So questions today. What happened to our guest worker program, the one that we had in the past? It was called the Bracero program, which translates to strong arm. Why does Canada have a guest worker program while the United States does not? Why is Canada's appear to be working, and why is ours not working? And finally, should the U.S. reestablish a guest worker program? And should we just pull ourselves together and face the fact that relying on illegal immigrant labor is not going to work in the long run, and we're going to have to come to grips with the fact that we need some help in our fields. We can't do it alone, need the help. So with us today, we have a couple of really good people who know all about farm labor. Ken Forth, he is the president of Foreign Agriculture Resource Management Services, which is known as FARMS. He is also an Ontario farmer, and he's been working on a president for, 5 years now of this organization?
A little more than that, but yes.
Okay. Also with us, Bruce Neuberger, who is the author of Lettuce Wars. He, a farm worker himself for almost 9 years out there in the lettuce fields, observing, chronicling, and working with the farm workers. So, what are we going to do, folks? Half of the food that we get comes from illegal farm labor. It's not going to be too long before the true costs of all that illegal labor come due, and it's going to cost us a lot of money. So should we come to grips with the fact that we need help and that we should formalize that help and treat them fairly and bring them into our workforce? That's the question on the table today, and you're invited to participate. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, at one time we had a bracero program that was a formal way of working with foreign guest workers. I mean, they were actually registered, came into California and throughout the country and worked and then took their money and went home. But we ended that program, got rid of it. And now the foreign guest workers have to sneak across the border, I guess, or they can participate in an H-2A program. But what happened to the bracero program? That's the question on the table right now. And let's go to Ken. Ken, you must have been watching this from Canada. You're a user of guest workers and probably a very significant part of your operation. So what happened to your friends down south? Why did they get rid of the bracero program?
You know what? I don't know anything about that program, but I certainly know about the H-2A program. I spoke to some American farm leaders last week, as a matter of fact, and one peach grower in Georgia was using the H-2A program exactly the same as we used the farms program in Ontario.
Wow.
So it's all there. I mean, the reason our program's been successful is pretty clear. We don't have anybody else here. Our farm labor came from displaced persons after the First and Second World War. By the mid-60s, they were farming or had found other occupations or were retired. And our immigration does not allow for people that would work on farms to come in and to immigrate to Canada permanently. So there was nobody. That's why we started this program. And the strength of the program simply is that it's government to government, number one. All the supply countries and our government deal with the specifics and the rules of the program together, along with representatives of the workers and the farmers. And it's been going on for 46, 47 years, and we review it annually. So if there's any issues, we deal with them. So there's never any big issues because they never become large. That's the strength of the program. But we had to make it work. Not that you guys don't. You guys had another source of labor too. So,
well, yeah, but it's illegal.
That's not my department to talk about right. Foreign immigration from in another country. That's not mine. I mean, it's not.
Of course not. But you know, we're trying to figure out why your H-2A program works and why ours doesn't.
Because we had to make it work because it was the only game in town.
Okay, so then what you're suggesting is we didn't have to make it work because there was the illegal immigrant laborers.
I guess, but I don't know that. I don't know the politics of California agriculture.
Yeah, of course. Well, neither do I. I don't know if anybody does. Maybe Bruce does. Bruce, why did we lose the...
The Bracero program? Why did we lose this Bracero? Is that what you said?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, the Bracero program was an emergency program originally because of the the need for labor in World War II. And so it was started in 1941. It was supposed to be a temporary program just for the duration of the war, but it was so popular among the growers, and not among the people working in the program, by the way, that they continued the program up until 1964. And the program was ended in 1964 for a variety of reasons, I think both domestic and international. But among the reasons I think that the right wing in this country didn't like the Bracero program was because it was leaky. And what I mean by that is, ever since California was established, which, let's be clear about this, it was the land was seized from Mexico in a war, an unjust war in 1848. And the labor system that was established on the land that was monopolized by a relative handful of people, mainly white Europeans, was a system of highly exploited labor from day one. Started with the Chinese, went through the Filipinos, and ultimately the Mexican.
Well, with all due respect, you know, as I open this program, it seems like we've always been relying on cheap labor and exploiting cheap labor since day one. And what I see in the history is that cheap labor always ends up costing society a ton of money. So the question is, why can't we have a program that works? I mean,
there's another issue in this. And the other issue simply is, when you have North American, the North American farm community, and we play by a lot of the same rules the Americans do, like the Canadian and U.S. rules aren't exactly the same, but they're pretty close. Anyway, our competition of food in Canada, at least, of food coming from abroad, and I don't mean necessarily America, I mean from outside of that. Right today on my farm, my labor component of my total cost is 45%.
Wow.
I am competing against people with a labor component of less than 4%. And there's no duty, no tariffs, no nothing. It just comes in here.
Now, where's that? Where is labor cost?
There's lots of places in the world that stuff comes in from. Lots of it. And we, if we want to talk about cheap labor, boy, we got to start talking about those third world nations that are supplying parts of America and Canada with some very cheap food produced very cheaply by, my gosh, like a 10% of what American and Canadian farmers are paying.
Bruce?
Well, I agree totally with what Ken is saying there, because actually what's happened, in, you know, since the 1970s when I was out there, is that the global system of production of food has dramatically changed. So the U.S. now is importing more food than it produces. Even more fruits and vegetables, which is pretty astounding. And so what that has done is it put increasing pressure on the price for farmers. You've got the big retailers like Walmart and Safeway and Kroger's and the rest that they put downward pressure on the prices as well. And so what's happened is that percolates down to the bottom to the farm worker who gets, you know, more and more exploited. And when I was working on this book on lettuce wars, and was interviewing people, I mean, I would just hear these stories about this incredible speed up that was going on out there. Wages have stagnated. You know, speed up is just horrendous. People are, you know, suffering tremendously from all kinds of problems, including psychological problems as a result of this kind of tremendous pressure that they're put under. And, you know, I think that we're just going to say, in terms of the undocumented immigrants, I don't call them that. I call them people deprived of documents, because this is a very systematic and very conscious program. This is not happening because people are sneaking across the border. This is happening because there's a very conscious program of maintaining a system of undocumented immigrants because they don't have the rights, actually, the ability to organize.
They're kind of like slaves because they don't have any rights.
They don't have any rights. Yeah. They don't have any rights. That's right. And the H-2A program, you know, is going on. I mean, I visited a labor camp in Salinas that I actually worked at years ago that was, you know, had H-2A workers. And it's very ironic that, you know, when I told other workers that I was interviewing that there were these, you know, H-2A workers, you know, so-called guest workers, in some ways they were envious of them, because they can cross the border without risking their lives. They can actually go and visit their families without risking their lives to come back. So here we have a program now, an H-2A program, which is, you know, I'm not in favor of, by the way, because it also restricts people's right to fight for better wages, better conditions, and so on. And if you don't have that right to organize and defend yourself, you're totally at the mercy, you know, of whoever it is that's hiring you.
It,
and a lot of these folks, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering about the Bracero program. We had a program that worked. Did the union, the UFW, get rid of the Bracero program?
No, the UFW didn't get rid of the program. In fact, the program ended in 1964 before the UFW really became much of a force.
Well, who got rid of it then?
Well, I think there were a number of different reasons. You know, first of all, there was mechanization going on. So there was a huge need for cotton workers in Texas, for example. When the machines came in, there was no longer a need for those Braceros. There was also the fact that internationally...
Hold that. We're going to have to take a quick break, Bruce. But when we come back, I'd like to follow that up. And I'd like to know why we got rid of a program that worked not well, or maybe not even great, but it worked, and we had guest workers. Now we don't have guest workers. We have undocumented or immigrants deprived of documents or whatever you call them. But they're going to be very expensive, so please do stay tuned. Slave labor was cheap, but then it became very expensive. Illegal immigrant labor is cheap, but it too is becoming very expensive. The extremely high cost of cheap labor leads us to ask, should we have a guest worker program? We had one at one time. We have one today, but nobody seems to want to use it all that much. Some people do, I guess. Canada has one that works. Why can't we be like Canada and formalize the relationship we have with our workers so that perhaps we could treat them a little more reasonably and get along a little bit better in the world of food? That's the question on the table. Bruce Neuberger, author of The Lettuce Wars, what happened to our Bracero program? Why did we get rid of it?
So the Bracero program went on from, like I said, 1941 to 1964. You know, if you recall, back in 1964, the country was changing. We had the Civil Rights Movement, which was beginning to change people's thinking about a lot of social issues. And so I think that was part of the awakening of the American public, was looking at this Bracero program and looking at it as a kind of a slave labor program, you know, a contract slave, if you want to put it that way. I think there was also international issues that were going on at that time. It just says Jim Crow, you know, segregation in the South was giving the U.S. a bad reputation around the world at a time when it was trying to parade itself as this great democratic power. I think the Bracero program also had a negative impact on its foreign image. So I think that was another reason. And another reason I think that this happened is because the people that backed the Bracero program, one of the reasons they did that is because they had this attitude, which has persisted in California ever since day one, which is that you want labor available when it's needed, and you want it to disappear when it's no longer needed. And the Bracero program was designed, or at least it seemed to satisfy that desire. But what happened with the Bracero program, as I said before, was a leaky program. A lot of the Braceros, in part because of the abuses that they suffered by the hands of various growers, unscrupulously, you know, not abiding by the contracts on their side of the equation. A lot of Braceros abandoned their farms and went into the cities and were beginning then to...
Sure. That's what happens today too. A lot of the farm workers escape the fields and go into the city and get a job in the city. And when it gets right down to it, just about every industry likes to hire illegal or undocumented or whatever you call them workers, simply because they have no rights. And if you look at all the rights legal domestic workers have, it's almost like the employer becomes a slave to the employee. because it's almost impossible to get rid of them or fire them when you don't want to have them anymore. So, you know, having an undocumented worker is kind of nice because you can get rid of them if you don't need them. So what does work seems to be this H-2A program in Canada. Bruce, do you see a difference between the H-2A program and the Bracero program?
You know, I can't really speak very, very deeply on that. I mean, the people that I talk to in the H-2A program, you know, they seem to be somewhat satisfied with it. But the problem here is, for example, let me give you an example.
So, wait a minute. You said that the farm workers who participate in this H-2A program, the foreign guest workers who participate in the program, seem to be satisfied with it. Is that what you said?
Well, but let me explain that a little bit because, you know, these are people that I interviewed, okay, in the camps. Now, I have to put this in the context because, for example, I was told by people from Oaxaca who were part of the H-2A program, they said they would not have come to the United States without it. Why? Because it is so deadly to cross that border. And so many people from their villages had disappeared on the way to the States. So they didn't want to take a chance, but when the H-2A program came along, you know, they were willing to do it because their safety was guaranteed. And a lot of the women from their villages, for example, they came across without documents. So, they were subject to rape and other kinds of sexual abuse. So it's in the context of a horrendous, dangerous, ugly system that people are, yes, okay, willing to do that. But it's only in the context of a really bad social situation.
Well, what would be the downside of it, though? I mean, I'm looking for some kind of downside to this H-2A program.
The H-2A program doesn't provide the right for workers to organize, to improve their conditions. So they really are subject to unscrupulous practices
Is that kind of like a regular 1099? It seems like the whole world is becoming 1099s now, you know, contract workers. And don't contract workers of most kinds end up with the same position where, well, this is what I agree to do, and these are the terms, and this is the way it is, and away we go?
Well, that's true. I mean, in other words, you're talking about the best of a bad situation. I can say that if there's some advantages for the work, like I just said, the workers that are H-2A. But if we're looking at a society, you're talking about the social costs of programs like this. Your social costs are you have a society where fewer and fewer people have rights, where the working class is going to be without any rights. And I don't think that's a good society.
Well, I don't think anybody thinks that except a few people. You know, let's go up north to Ken Forth, who's been doing this for president of the Farms Organization, which is Foreign Agriculture Resource Management. You've been working with foreign guest workers for a long time. Do you see a racial element or component in farm labor, Ken?
Here's what I see. First of all, we don't have a California employer here or a representative of the employers. I have the same issue in Canada, where we have so-called advocate groups that say we're all bad. All the time. There's not one good. Those folks will never say one good thing about the program. They won't. I deal with it daily. So this isn't new. I've been on several farms in California over the last 25 years, and I haven't seen what's been described here. I haven't seen that. I don't know who you can have working for you, whether he makes $100,000 a year or $100 a year, where you can intimidate him and get any kind of production out of it. Like if I have executives working for me for $100,000 and I start intimidating them, my production is going to go through the floor.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And we're going to pick you up when we come back. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, 831-479-1080. Give us a call. Well, in thinking what Ken Forth said with respect to having a relationship with an employee and treating him poorly, I can't see how you could treat an employee poorly with whom you have a formal relationship. You know, he is a contract employee. You've hired him to do or her to do something. They do their job, and boy, that's a good relationship. On the other hand, if you have a person working for you that has no rights by virtue of the fact that they are not legal, there is no legal contract or relationship there, that might be a different thing. I don't know, what do you think of farmers, Bruce? You're a critic of the industry. Are all farmers bad?
No, I don't think all farmers are bad.
All farmers are bad?
No, I don't. Is that the question? No, not by any means. In fact, look, I don't look at this in a personal way. I look at it as the system that causes people to do what they do. You know, farmers are under a tremendous amount of pressure, and obviously there are bigger farmers that put pressure on the smaller farmers. And so on.
Everybody's competing. I mean, that's the nature. Competing. Yeah,
that's right. And it's a global system, as Ken pointed out. It's a global system where, you know, the conditions for farm laborers and the wages that they pay in other countries are even more onerous than they are here. So the farmers in the United States, and I suppose in Canada as well, are competing against. And I think Ken was pointing this out. Again, it's competing against even cheaper, you know, products in other countries, and so it's a losing situation for a lot of people, and particularly I am concerned about it's a losing situation for the workers because they're under more and more pressure. Now, you know, right now they have labor contractors in the fields of Salinas. This has become, you know, overwhelming, this labor contractor system. And it came into its full flower, you might say, after the union movement was defeated in the early 80s. And these labor contractors, and there was a study done out of the UC Berkeley, you know, organization of investigators, they came to the conclusion that labor contractors not only have the ability to cheat their workers, but they have to cheat their workers in order to make their own ends meet. So, you know, if you look at I think it's the overall situation we're looking at here. I mean, we can talk
Wouldn't this make sense, Bruce, if we had a system like Ken Forth and the Canadian industry has, whereby the growers get together and develop a nonprofit organization to administer a program that formalizes a relationship with guest workers so that you have this relationship, a formal relationship, and you're not dealing with these terribly exploitive situations. Ken, let me ask Ken. Ken, do your guest workers feel exploited?
I don't think the worker does. I think there are advocate groups that will just say that, because there are advocate groups in this country, too, that will just say anything. And again, I have to say, my experience is not what has been described in California or in Ohio or Michigan or in Canada. It has not been that way. I mean, I have a relationship with the workers that work for me because we're all in this together, baby. And if there's not enough money at the end of the year, there isn't going to be a farm. That's the way it works. And I don't think there's anything any different anywhere else. I really don't. It's easy to say all workers are being exploited. Let's use a scenario. You have an executive making $150,000 a year, and you say to him, would you like to make more money? Sure, I'd like to make more money. Everybody would have a yes answer to that. And then the next day in the newspaper would say, executive not satisfied with pay, where he may be very satisfied. But the question was, do you want to make more money? Yeah. So, and it's turned around. Lots of things in this country are turned around like that. It's very explosive, and it's simply not the case.
So you have a system that works. You have a system that's put together by, it's a private company working with government rules, right? governments establish the rules
and
the relationship?
We work with all the governments in this program. We work with the Canadian government, and all the pieces are put together. But there's lots of people who do not like the program out there that are not in our in our business. Reason? They want to run the program.
Oh. Bruce, do you want to run the program?
No, I don't want to run the program. We're just talking about, you know, the social conditions for the workers, and what I understand those social conditions to be. I don't know anything about Ken's farm or his relations with his workers. He may have really good relations with his workers. I'm not trying to personalize this. I'm trying to look at the overall situation. And Ken before had talked about this competition. He made a point about this competition. And this competition internationally is driving conditions down. And I think whether it's an H-2A program or whether it's the present program with labor contractors, these pressures exist. And they will continue to exist.
Not just in farming, though. Look what happened to the manufacturing sector in North America.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the thing. You know, the automobile industry and the steel industry, they could pick up and they could go to another country. The garment industry. But a farmer can't. So what ends up happening with this kind of competition?
Well, the farmers
drive the conditions down further.
Yeah, the farmers are leaving and going to other countries. Well, folks, we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to ask the question. We have a situation in Canada, a program that works. We have one in America, United States, that does not work. Can we make the system in United States work as efficiently as the one in Canada? This is the Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson, and I will be right back. Well, the Foreign Agriculture Resource Management Services up there in Canada is a guest worker program that appears to be working really well. And the reason, from what I gather from this program, that it works really well is that there is no alternative, which is to say there must not be a lot of illegal immigrant labor. Is that true, Canforth?
Yeah, there's not a lot of illegal immigrants in Canada. There's probably some, but the percentage is very, very tiny.
Very, very tiny. Whereas here in the United States, we have a guest worker program, the H-2A program, that works only on a very small scale because the alternative is huge, which is, of course, undocumented or illegal immigrant labor. So why should agriculture, or why should any industry go to an H-2A program when it's just possible to go to the in illegal immigrant workforce?
I don't know the answer to that, but here's what I do know. I have not heard anybody on this program from the industry say it's not what they have currently isn't working. I haven't heard that. So I'm not going to delve into some California or U.S. politics here by saying one should replace the other. I don't know. The only thing we had in Canada was the seasonal worker program. We had to make it work because that was it. Or we didn't have workers at all, or at least not enough. We employ a lot of Canadians, but there's simply not enough. And so maybe what they have there works. I don't know that.
Well, according to the headlines of the local paper, you know, crops are going unpicked in the fields this year because they don't have enough workers.
Okay.
So maybe it isn't working all that well. Let me ask you, Bruce, what do you think? Could you think we can make this work if we had to, if there was no alternative, if there were no undocumented workforce, could we make a program work here?
Could we? Well, I wouldn't be part of it, but could the growers make an H-2A program work here?
Yeah.
I think that depends on how desperate people are. I mean, you have to realize that one of the reasons why the agricultural system in California is working is because NAFTA drove millions of peasants off their land, corn farmers from Mexico. It was estimated that something like 1 to 15 million peasants were going to be driven out by, you know, the provisions of NAFTA, and it's come to pass. So you have desperate people who come up here, and that has been the labor force. That's been the labor force in California for forever. I mean, I'm not in favor of that, okay? Now, I'm just curious though, just to ask, if it's possible to ask Ken a question. That is, would he be willing to see his workers or the workers in the Canadian area organize a union and sit down and bargain for what they think are the conditions that would be you know, just under those conditions?
Well, what do you think, Ken? Would you be willing to see your guest workers organize a union?
Two issues. Number one, not that I'm either for or against it. An industrial work site, Mr. Car Builder in Detroit, does not live there. If there is a strike at my farm, my seven-year-old daughter, or if I have one, has to cross a picket line to get the school bus, and what happens on that issue? I don't know. These are private homes. We're not talking about factories here. We're talking about private, personal family places that would be disrupted greatly. I don't know what the trauma is of a seven-year-old crossing a picket line. I've crossed them. I know what it was like for me, but I was an adult. Maybe it's even worse for a kid. I don't know. We also produce something that's living. I don't care what it is, whether it's a cow or a peach or a broccoli or a lettuce. It's living. Recognizing the fact that a strike in a car plant is probably catastrophic for the shareholders and the owners of that car plant. But 10 days, 10 minutes, 10 months, 10 years later, that minivan is still sitting there half built and can be built.
And there you go. We ran out of time. Folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Thank you all for tuning in. Thanks to Ken and thanks to Bruce.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.